And present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg and Representatives Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire.
We have a quorum, and we'll be joined shortly by the other members. First up today, we have House Bill Number 14, Disclosures by Foster Parents, and we have Heather Norbrega. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you.
Old stomping grounds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Heather Norbrega, staff to Representative Roekberg, and I'm here to present House Bill 14. House Bill 14 basically came about as a result of working with some constituents over the last year. It came to our attention that foster parents actually are not allowed, really, are not supposed to be communicating confidential information regarding the children that they are in their care. Therefore, they really can't really call and communicate with their legislator if they have a problem regarding someone who's in their care and they need some help. So House Bill 14 allows foster parents to call their legislator and speak with their legislator, a member of the legislative staff, regarding the children that are in their care. And that's basically the gist of what the bill does. I would like to say that it has been brought to our attention that there might be some conflicts with federal law on this bill, so I would respectfully ask the committee to hold it for now as we are exploring the federal implications that this bill might have with some of the requirements we're providing. But I did want to get the bill on the record and make you guys aware of the bill in case we did get those problems worked out, and then we can go forward. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I know representatives from OCS are here to comment as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Norbrega. I heard the bill and Hess, so I don't have any questions. Do you, Representative Dahlstrom or Coghill?
Aye.
If you're going to be around, we could hear from OCS. Representative Coghill. Why don't we hear from Office of Children's Services, and then so we have Tammy Sandoval.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Today?
Yes.
Good. Yeah, I know. We all.
Right.
Heather and I. Well, we were all on the same plane too. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval, and I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services. House Bill 14, as was told, proposes to allow foster parents of children in the custody of the department to disclose privileged and confidential information regarding the child to a legislator or to a member of their staff for review or use in their official capacity. Subsequent to this bill passing out of House Hess, we became concerned because we learned from our federal partners, the representatives from Region 10, that we would be in violation of federal law and federal Title 4E and 4E reimbursements that would be jeopardized if Alaska's foster parents were added to the existing language of statutes 4710.092. We estimate that this would be, this could result in an approximate $29.7 million loss of federal reimbursements for fiscal year 2006. We've provided committee members a copy of the federal language that was brought to our attention just last week. Absolutely, for the record, I just want to say that we want to be responsive to the needs of foster parents, that we believe that existing statute 4710.080 subsection Q clearly defines and limits what specific information foster parents are entitled to. They are entitled to the child's case plan, medical, mental health, and educational information regarding the child to assist them in providing the proper care for that child, in addition to information to help assure the safety of the child and their own family safety. The same statute also clearly requires foster parents to maintain confidentiality of records regarding a child placed in their home, except when the disclosure of the records is necessary to obtain medical and education services for the child, for example, providing information to physicians. We believe that there are several avenues by which foster parents can provide input or get their needs met through our system. Foster parents are part of the regular case review system, which allows them to express concerns they have about the plan and or services being provided for children in their care. They're allowed and encouraged to attend court hearings, provide testimony to the judge. They're welcome to contact their licensing specialist, the assigned worker, obviously, their worker's social worker supervisor, and then there are other levels as well. The staff manager, the regional children's services manager, and just this morning I responded to a concern. So there are several lines of communication by which we hope that foster parents can get their needs met through us. Additionally, foster parents have access to a formal grievance process in the ombudsman's office if they feel the issues they have with the department are not being resolved. For that reason, the department opposes House Bill 14. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Coghill.
So that we know what a foster parent can say to a legislator, why don't you give us an idea what now, right now, legally, technically, a foster parent can come to a legislator with and say, we have a problem with this process or this issue?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, we were just talking about those things coming in as we were waiting, and I think that there's a number of things that foster parents can say. What we're concerned about is confidential information. I mean, it seems like specifically what we want to be able to do is talk to you about our process rather than specific information about a child, rather talk about our policies and procedures and the normal process. And you alerting us is one thing. What's being said and what we can say back is another.
I understand the part of the bill that talks about the information a legislator might want from OCS, and the issues on that part aside is the part on page 3, which is letting a foster parent discuss things with their legislator, and I apologize for getting here late. What is the law right now? It seems to me a foster parent, I didn't know that a foster parent was prevented right now from discussing things that they knew, even if it was part of a confidential proceeding.
Can I get some assistance?
Stacy, can you be of some help in the matter?
Well, I know that Representative Garrett, through chair, I've you know, cited statutes, but I didn't bring my statute book here, and so I was wondering if, Stacy, you could be of some help in the matter. Can you have some help in the matter?
Maybe.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General, the Department of Law. And I was, can you state that just one more time so I understand?
What is it that the law would prevent a foster parent from talking about, assuming the foster parent had knowledge of it? Are there things a foster parent couldn't talk to a legislator about if they knew about it, just because it's part of a confidential proceeding?
Well, through the chair, Representative Guerra, theoretically, the information in a CHINA proceeding, Child in Need of Aid proceeding, is confidential across the board. And under 4710.093, oh, hang on here, let me find it here. Yeah, I know. Oh, under 092, which is the statute that's being sought to be amended here, under subparagraph C, theoretically, there's criminal penalties for violating the confidentiality provisions. So, a foster parent who has access to confidential information should, as the statute is currently envisioned, not call their legislator and divulge that confidential information, and doing so would potentially subject them to criminal penalties. The question is what Ms. Sandoval mentioned, is the reciprocity, if you will. If a foster parent calls a legislator and says, I've got a problem with the Office of Children's Services and X, whatever the issue may be, as long as it's not a confidential communication, then the legislator can call the Office of Children's Services and say, we've got this issue, and we can talk about the process. It's just getting into the underlying confidential information, the case plan, information about the parents, information about the children, what sort of services they're receiving. That information, by law, is confidential, and theoretically, if divulged by anybody, even by the Office of Children's Services, we're subject to criminal penalties, potential criminal penalties, Class B misdemeanor.
I don't know if we have our lines crossed on this, and it's certainly it can be viewed as a gray area, but it shouldn't be. It seems to me that if a foster parent sees a child being abused by the natural parent, the foster parent could call OCS, even though that evidence was also part of the confidential China proceeding. I mean, it seems to me that the law couldn't be interpreted to mean you can't talk to somebody about what you saw once it becomes part of the confidential proceeding. You just can't talk about the things that you only know because they've gone out in the confidential proceeding, right?
Through the chair, that's exactly right. And nothing within this construct or what we're talking about would preclude anybody, let alone a foster parent, from making a report to the Office of Children's Services or to any of you in your legislative capacities about a child being harmed and have us come in and investigate. That wouldn't be precluded.
So if you have independent knowledge of the thing that's part of the confidential proceeding, you can talk about it. If your only knowledge is from the confidential proceeding, then you can't talk about it.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Well, but it brings up an interesting point. I mean, at the heart of child in need of aid, you've got some kind of a crisis that's occurred for the proceeding to be taking place in the first place. And if at the root of it, it's a series of reported abuses that have taken place over, let's say, a couple of years, and there are multiple affidavits to that effect, and a foster parent has independent knowledge of that they believe would pertain or relate in some way to the proceeding. I mean, it's a fine line, I think. I don't think it's as clear-cut as if you have independent knowledge, you're okay, and this child and the process is necessarily going to serve them well.
I agree with you. It is a fine line. I think the distinction that is made within the context of this statute is that type of information that you independently receive, or the information that a foster parent would receive as a result of being retained as a foster parent, and then would have access to information and thereby call a legislator or call a third party and basically waive a parent's privacy rights. That's the concern, and the child's privacy rights for that matter. But you know, the question is making sure that the information that a foster parent has is kept in the highest of confidence, and only in those circumstances where that it's, you know, if they call a legislature and they have a concern, I mean, we want to hear those things. We want to respond to them. The Office of Children's Services wants to hear from your offices as well. The question is, how much detail can we exchange with you in response to a comment that's made by a foster parent? And the concern here is that if we open it up so that we can talk about those confidential matters without a waiver from a parent, without a parent saying, hey, I'll waive my privacy rights or you can talk to whomever you want, then we risk losing all this federal funding.
I understand that. And just in follow-up, because one of the things that I know Representative Roekberg did was go through the bill and take out any reference to private or confidential information about the family, and so that it was reduced down to the foster child themselves. And so we got rid of that concern, but I understand your point that it's still fundamentally the parent's child until it's not. I understand that. This is a tough bill, but I will tell you, it hits on a nerve for a lot of lawmakers because, you know, I look at the two of you and I think you're doing a great job, and I do. And I would trust the information that you gave me. I would think that it was right, but, you know, from year to year to year, we don't always know who's going to be sitting in your positions. And sometimes things fall through the cracks, and it makes it very difficult if, as a society, we say we want to further this goal of accepting foster kids into your home. We want you to act as their parent. We want you to take responsibility for their nutrition, getting them to school, making sure their mental well-being is okay, all these things. But in some way, and you heard this testimony in Hess, in some way we're going to kind of tie your arms behind your back a little bit, though. Because if there's a place where you feel in acting as that child's parent and all the things that come with it, that you would like to have a different outcome, that the department isn't responding in a way you'd like, or whatever that is, that they don't have the ability to then go to their lawmaker the way parents would and say, I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned about this process. And I think, and that's the concern that Representative Roekberg is bringing up, and I know other members of the HES committee expressed that there have been times they want to be able to get information to act on behalf of this foster family in a way that they think is beneficial. And it's a really delicate balance. But Representative Dahlstrom and then Gira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your comments on disclosure forms. And, you know, for the record, I just like to state the few cases that I have been involved with, the information that I needed to get in order to help the family involved and also work with the department was something that was, I don't want to say easy to obtain, but the parents were willing to sign that disclosure form. And that's all it took in order for me to then communicate with the medical folks that were involved, people from the department, foster parents. Every single one of them made sure that I had that disclosure form. But because that was in place, I was able to do what I needed to, what I could do to help. And I was reassured when every one of them made sure that I had that disclosure form and that they weren't just giving out, you know, information. So, you know, I guess because of the experiences that I've had in this area and working with folks on both sides of this, I'm comfortable that there is some information that has to remain confidential, or within there's a tight group that it needs to stay.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting legislative process because it was unanimous in HES. I mean, bipartisan support for the bill. It was unanimous. It was a really completely different sort of set of experiences, and I guess that just goes to show some have better and some have worse, you know. But that was, it was Representative Roekberg's experience with the process that prompted the bill, that he didn't have a positive one and didn't feel he was able to get.
And just to follow up on that, I think, you know, if it kind of depends on how we frame the issue. If we ask, are we interested in children and what's in their best interest and getting the information we need, there isn't a single one of us that wouldn't say, yes, that's what we want to do. But when we do look at the fact that not all of our citizens use information in the correct way, and not all of them use it for the betterment of the child, and that sometimes there are ulterior motives, which is very sad, but that's why we're here discussing these things, you know.
Yeah. Representative
Garrett. Right, I have mixed feelings about this too. And Representative Dahlstrom has alluded to it, though I haven't spoken to Representative Dahlstrom about this. I know this summer there was the big case in the Valley that got all the news attention, and I spoke to some of the other legislators who got the confidential briefing that the department provided. I wasn't able to attend. I spoke to a member from the Senate, another member from the House, and people who are quite skeptical, people who... are quite skeptical about sort of whether or not the government does a very good job in certain areas that they work. And they came all, both of them came out of that confidential briefing saying that the news story, because it was based on just what was public, really missed out on the I's that were dotted and the T's that were crossed by OCS members, and that they felt that OCS had, in that case, even though they were publicly vilified, had done quite a good job on that case. Now, I can only talk secondhand. I'm just talking from the other people who've spoken to me. And so I guess the bill is prompted by the thing that happened this summer. I feel quite comfortable that at least people that I trust felt that OCS did a good job. I suppose I should have been part of that briefing, too, and I just wasn't able to make it. But absent some sort of real showing that OCS is acting abusively in this area, incompetently in this area, I don't know that I'm willing to sort of shift this delicate balance that the law has drawn also. I'm willing to listen, but I'm less concerned about what happened this summer. I'm less concerned that OCS engaged in any sort of misconduct.
All of a sudden, I missed that briefing too, unfortunately. So, Representative Coghill.
Some of that discussion will be taken up in a bill that we'll be seeing in front of us too. On once people have disclosed certain information to the public, then the department would be able to respond to that, which is a little different subject right. than what we're dealing with here. And generally speaking, I am going to be there for the parent. I think the natural parent has a supremacy, but there are sometimes that parents do things that they ought not to do, and that child needs to be taken into custody. So we have elevated over the last several years the position of the foster parent, mainly because we've been trying to get kids into foster care. So maybe this does go a little too far, but I think the frustration is that many times we're called upon to be kind of the watchdog, for lack of a better word, over some of the department actions. As long as we can push the process questions, I think I'm satisfied. To delve into the trickier matters, there are some things that you can do by force of conversation with the parent and OCS that will bring some help. But at the end of the day, it's going to be in the courts where that information is going to finally have to take some effort. And I suppose, and this is just for me, I struggle with this also because I take it very, very seriously. I get, I don't know how many calls for people to help navigate the system. It's a very complex system. And I don't want to turn them away, but there are a lot of times we don't get the whole story either. Struggle.
And then the only other point, and this is a really good discussion, I think better, but even maybe a better one than having the other committee more thorough, is that, you know, I think the other reason why I gravitated toward this bill is some of the problems that arose, and there's another bill that addresses it, is, you know, by and large, when you want something to be confidential, it's for the benefit of that person. And it's for good reasons, and so we developed a system around this confidentiality notion. And what we found, and Representative Gary, I know, has been involved, and Representative Coghill too, and Dahlstrom during the interim, is that when this particular situation arose, again, not pointing fingers at anybody, some inherent flaws in the system arose that we all kind of had to look at. And one of the things that was discussed is providers being able to share information with one another. Very important information about behavioral problems, something that would help the child's well-being, for example. And there's a bill that looks at how that information could be shared in a way that protects the child and the child's family, but that also goes on to sort of serve, I would say, serve the child's best interest and also the community's interest. And so I think that's another thing that's out there that makes it, you know, I think a lot of us kind of gravitated to, and Carol Como, who's my constituent, incidentally was here last week, and in the situation she's dealing with, she pointed right to things like this and said, you know, Liesl, I mean, if the department knows, if the state agencies know that this, some of these individuals have had behavioral problems that put them, other students at risk, I need to know that. And I understand that these confidentiality rules are in place, but there's got to be a way to communicate because it's not fair to the other kids in the classroom and so on. So that's just a whole other part of it. But I think that's why, you know, we're all kind of, and if nothing else, even if the bill ends up not going anywhere because it doesn't comport with federal law, at least the discussion's out there about what things we want confidential and how far we want to make them confidential.
Thank you. For the record, I just want to note that I was able to participate in those confidential briefings on the terrible situation this past summer. And
I also was involved in the case because several members of the family on both sides and from several different states contacted me. And I will tell you that what was stated in the paper and this individual, I don't want to say stories, but the individual feelings of what had actually happened with each person was different. And what was stated in the paper was at least 50% inaccurate. And because of what, you know, is in place to protect the children, no one could come back and defend why they had done what they had done. After leaving those hearings, I was confident before, but I was even more confident then that OCS had done what they needed to do and in a timely fashion. But I also want to say on that note that I have never had a conversation with anyone at any level at OCS who has never said they are open to discussion on improvement, want to change things if it needs to be, want to change statutes, want to provide better training for workers, realize there's a huge burnout rate because of the stress of this, because of the amount of caseworkers that we have per child, just the dynamics of our state being so different. When we have a caseworker that's responsible for people all over our, you know, our huge state, and then, you know, a case like this, which is horrible, there's not words to describe it, comes up, but there are so many cases they're involved in that are so successful, we don't hear about them. And this case was made even worse because inaccurate information was disseminated, and they didn't have an opportunity. They couldn't legally respond. But and as you stated, if because of federal regulations, you know, this nothing happens with this, I think there's good to come of it because we're having these conversations, and this bill that Representative Coghill referenced, I'm looking forward to. You know, working on that, providers being able to share information. And again, from my own experience with constituent issues, that's critical.
Yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Two things, Madam Chair. Number one, a technical thing. In the bill, I'm sorry, in the statute itself, 4710, 092 subsection C, which is the thing that we're looking at here, it's not set out here, but let me read it to you. A person who violates a provision of this section is guilty of a misdemeanor and upon conviction is punishable by a fine of not more than 500 or imprisonment for not more than 1 year or both. I'd also point out the statute that I distributed a minute ago, AS 24.60.060, and I would ask, we should actually distribute subsection C. I'm going to offer an amendment to this that would amend subsection C that I've just read to say it is also, as applicable, a violation of AS 24.60.060, which is the specific legislative confidentiality. And I'll distribute that other statute, sir, if you make a copy of that. That was number one. Number two, I know in certain let me get to my question first, and I'll say where I'm coming from. Is there any requirement that the legislator or staffer sign a confidentiality statement? I know when they disclose confidential oil and gas information, we have to sign such a confidentiality statement. Is there a requirement? And I've been trying to find where that is in the law. Does anybody around here know where that is in the law?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe.
And you guys go with the signature, the form, like for temporary assistance?
Okay, under Title 4705, I might be testing my memory here. There's a provision under Title 47 that require that mandates that temporary assistance information is confidential, and I don't remember the exact site. And within that construct, or within that statute, there's a provision which requires that a legislature, as implementing that temporary assistance in the Department of Health and Social Services, developed a form which is basically, if we give you this confidential information, you're going to sign this form and realize it's confidential and not redisclose it. The Office of Children's Services has basically bootstrapped that document and used it for purposes of confidential information under 4710, although there's not a corresponding statutory provision such as the one for temporary assistance.
Do you think that while we're doing this here, Stacy, you can take a look and we can find that? Because I think there should be. Do you need a copy of Title 47?
It's 4705020.
4705020.
Yeah.
Regulations, disclosure, here we go. Here. I will. Why don't you? Are you going to be wanting to deal with amendments today, Madam Chair, or do we have a little time?
Yes, so a legislator to whom information relating to the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program is disclosed under the section may not further disclose the information except to another legislature and then legislator, and then only in connection with official purposes within each legislator's legislative functions and related to the administration of the program consistent with federal law.
So, you know, at this time, I think what I'll do is go ahead and finish public testimony and then set the bill to the side. There's really no point to continue further on until we know what's going to happen with the federal law conflict issue. So why don't we keep in our packets the photocopy that Representative Gruenberg disseminated, and we'll pick up where we left off today once we hear back on that subject. Is there anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify in House Bill number 14? Anybody on the telephone lines? Okay, so hearing none.
Can I check one?
Sure, sure, Ms. Nobrega, forward.
I just, for the record again, this is Heather Nobrega from Representative Roekberg's office. I just wanted to clarify that actually this bill is not the result of the Kelly case from the Valley last summer. We actually had a constituent who is a foster parent who was under the impression that, and actually there's a letter to this effect in your packets, that they were being dissuaded from contacting their legislator's office. Mm-hmm. So that's why we brought this bill forward. They contacted our office regarding repayment of some monies they had paid out for one of their foster children to go on a trip to Russia. So I just want to clarify, that's where our stance is coming from, not from actually the Kelly case from this last summer. So. I just wanted to put that on record. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we will set House Bill number 14 to the side. Thank you very much. Okay, House Bill number 12. Are you ready, Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, ma'am.
Not now, when?
You know that somebody, a famous man, said that.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. We should have, Madam Chair, a copy of work draft R.
Put it on everyone's desk, so look in front of you.
You saw it. That's all covered under the bill now. Said, but I gave it.
Right in it, slid.
This is all in the bill. Okay,
so,
Madam Chair.
Have we adopted minutes?
Okay, no. We did.
So we have version X in front of us?
No, we have version R.
Oh, that's right. My apologies.
24LS0058/R, 41105. That's the latest. I would offer that as a proposed CS.
Is there any objection to that being adopted for purposes of discussion?
No.
Okay, hearing none, we have version R before us. Representative Gruenberg.
Okay. Do you have the markup showing all the things we've got?
No, but I
can
put this is right.
Okay. What we have done, Madam Chair, since the last time is on page 2, as a result of Representative Anderson's comments, on line 4, we have exempted portable cellular telephones, and that includes, Tom, do you want another copy of the bill?
Yeah, please. Thanks.
There you go. Do you have a copy of the bill?
Yeah.
Okay. We have, I've got it here.
Thank you. It is right here,
so. Oh. Okay. See. You've got a couple copies here, I think. We have exempted portable cellular phones. That includes both audio and visual telephones. And we have added on lines 6 and 7 and 8 audio equipment information functions and controls. And that is the thing you were talking about, your friend. And we have also added on line 7 and 8 describing the vehicle information we're involved with here, displays for the controls relating to speed, fuel level, battery charge, other vehicle safety or equipment information. That is added. And the only other issue was Representative Cott's issue dealing with somebody who has an RV, a recreation vehicle. And we've been on the telephone a lot with the industry and the RV folks. And the information, they liked the model language, which went to business and entertainment, things that we got away with because it was just too nebulous. And the they said also that they all have TVs in the front which disconnect once the ignition is turned on. So they're already covered. And I got an email from them, which I'll pass out now, that confirms, if we could take one pass along, that the Recreation Vehicle Industry Association supports TV monitor legislation, including a provision to be in view of the driver if and only if the TV has a device that, when the motor vehicle is being driven, disables the TV for all uses except as a visual display for vehicle information, global positioning systems, or the purpose of low-speed maneuvering of the vehicle. That's already in the bill. I think they're taken care of, and hopefully the bill's ready to move.
Good. Okay, further discussion on Representative Guerra. We have version R in front of us. Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Considering the amendments, I support the legislation. Appreciate Representative Grunberg's assistance with that facilitation. So I move CS for House Bill with individual recommendations and attached, I don't know if it's a zero fiscal note.
Or
zero fiscal notes.
Okay, any objection to that motion? Hearing none, at long last.
And Ms. Carpinetti is involved with this a lot of this too. Thank you.
Yes, for House Bill number 12, individual recommendations and 4-0 fiscal notes is moved. Okay, that brings us to Senate Bill number 105. And Vanessa, was somebody going to be here from Senator Seekin's office? Or?
I will call them right now.
Let's take a brief at ease. At 10 to 2, or 5 to 2, and we do have the Senator's representative here, Mr. Hove. Is there anything that you wanted to add on the record regarding Senate Bill number 105? If not, we've got Representative Guerra has questions for Mr. Mitchell.
I don't have anything on the record. I can answer questions or whatever the committee would have in mind.
Why don't we go ahead and take questions from Mr. Mitchell, and then if you want to comment after those are done. Mr. Mitchell? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Mitchell. There was some representation, maybe by both sides, I'm not sure, about the meaning of this original 19... I think there were a series of memos in the 1980s, a 1986 memo from the Department of Labor, an earlier one from the Department of Law. And there's been some discussion about whether those members, whether those memos made it clear that Hegland was not required to pay overtime. And I guess my question is, did those memos make that clear, or was it not so clear? That's what I'd like to address.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'd say that the initial memos, the 1980 memo and the 1984 memo, are Attorney General opinions. Those are really the kind of the foundation for the Department of Labor's interpretation on this issue. And that's where we got into that flow chart the last time. That's can be confusing if you're, you know, if you go through it real quick. The 1986 memo is an opinion letter that was written to the Alaska Air Carriers Association from the Deputy Director of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety at that time in 1986. Those opinion letters are designed to respond to a particular question, a particular set of facts. This opinion letter is written in such a way that it appears to be making a policy type of decision that conflicts with the Attorney General's opinion. I think that's kind of sums up the conflict between these opinions. Does that answer your question?
Representative Giroux?
Thanks. Chair, the 1986 memo, mm-hmm. I guess, says if, assuming your employees are non-union employees, leave that to the side, if there's substantial hauling of the mail, I guess are the words that are used, then, and you're an in-state carrier, so if you're an in-state carrier, it seems to say if there's substantial hauling of the mail, then the overtime provisions don't apply? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gere, that's correct.
Tell me, in the case of Hagland, were they involved in what would be called substantial hauling of the mail?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure what I understood that they did haul the mail, but I don't know what amount or.
And are you saying that the earlier memos then, how did the 1986 memo conflict with the earlier memos from the Department of Law? Or seemingly conflict, I guess.
Well, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the 1986 memo essentially takes the position of establishing the federal guideline for overtime eligibility of employees of air carriers. That's a pretty big step for an opinion letter without any regulation or AG opinion or something like that to fall back on.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Anybody else on the committee? Okay, hearing none. Senator Seekins has joined us. Any questions for Senator Seekins? Okay, appreciate a motion. Representative Cott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, with that, I would move that we move out committee, Senator 105, with individual recommendations and company fiscal note.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, Senate Bill number 105 is moved. Thank you, Mr. Sponsor, Mr. Chairman.
And sorry, Senator Seekins, that we didn't pass it out sooner after you arrived.
Yes. I thought we had an extended debate on
30 seconds, that was far too long.
Thank you, Senator Seekins. Okay, that brings us to HJR number 9. And staff to Representative Ledoux. State your name for the record and tell us what this House Joint Resolution does.
Madam Chairman, for the record, I'm Suzanne Hancock, staff to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. She greatly appreciates you hearing this bill today, or this resolution today. She'd be here, except she's ill. This resolution from the Alaska State Legislature would urge the United States Congress to respect the judicial process and refrain from enacting any legislation that would alter the punitive damages award to more than 32,000 plaintiffs as a result of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill, as finally determined by the federal courts. Nearly 15 years after the disaster and more than 10 years after the original jury verdict, the plaintiffs are still waiting resolution of the lawsuit. While the United States Congress considered the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, ExxonMobil Corporation sought an amendment that would have substantially reduced the punitive damages that would have been paid for the Exxon Valdez oil spill. This resolution urges Congress only to let the courts determine this matter.
Questions for the sponsor's representative? Representative Gruenberg.
Well, we've just been wrestling with this issue in the last bill, haven't we? Whether you can change something retroactively. After a and I thought the memo we just got said that after a final judgment you could not do it constitutionally. It seems to me that at least there's a very good argument that any such amendment, insofar as it would have attempted to reduce punitive damages legislatively after a final judgment, would run afoul of the federal due process clause. And I don't know if we want to see about a legal opinion on that and maybe put something in another whereas that might very well be unconstitutional. It's up to the sponsor, but we just got ahead of a big memo on that.
Representative Guerra.
I think the loophole Exxon is trying to work with on this one, or the approach they're trying to take, is they're trying to vacate the final judgment and then hope that Congress changes the law so that they can't be held as liable in the future. So they're on appeal.
Yeah, final judgment.
They're trying to get rid of the punitive damage verdict, get it set up for retrial or rehearing by the court. Once the final judgment disappears, then they feel that they'll be free to get Congress to write the law in a way that will prevent the fishermen from getting the same judgment as they got the last time. So I don't think it's inconsistent. And frankly, I don't know if what they're doing is legal or constitutional, but that's how they address your point. They're trying to vacate the final judgment.
Makes sense. So any statement reaffirming what we already know, which is that if there is a final judgment, can't make it retroactive, really would be moot. I mean, it doesn't address the point.
I'm sure.
Representative Guerra.
I guess I would just relay this to Representative Ledoux.
Mm-hmm.
It's for her to accept or not accept. I think the resolution makes sense. I've been on record saying the same thing in the past. I started out in the state working on the Exxon Valdez case for the state, and we got lucky. We settled our case with the state, so we don't have to. The state didn't have to wait for its payment, but Exxon certainly didn't do the same thing with the private plaintiffs, and they're still waiting. I think, frankly, the resolution should also ask the governor to make the same demand upon Exxon. I tried to get the attorney general last year to make the same demand upon Exxon, and my invitation was declined. So many of us legislators have made the demand on Exxon. We think not only should the legislature, as we would, but we think the governor should too, and Congress. So, If the representative isn't interested in making any of those changes, I'd certainly work with her. It's time passed.
Okay. We have two people so far only to testify. So if you're here in the audience or online to testify on House Joint Resolution Number 9, let somebody know. Jerry McCune with the United Fishermen of Alaska.
Thank
you. Welcome, Mr. McCune.
My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska and Cordova District Fishermen United. And we support the resolution for several reasons. There's been two cases in Supreme Court that sent the Ninth Circuit Court back to Judge Holland to rule on to see if it affected the case. 8-1 formula, blah, blah, blah. The governor has already called, I think it was 2 months ago, called for all parties to settle this case, if I remember right. And also, our attorneys watch all the time for something to being added on to another bill in Congress that might or might not affect us in some way. There's a lot of ways to, the way I understand it from my attorneys, and there's attorneys all over the place on this case, Madam Chair, that there's certain things that you could probably try to insert to affect the outcome. All we're asking is for the let the courts rule on this, win, lose, or draw.
Any questions of Mr. McCune? Representative Guerra.
Just to be clear, Mr. McCune is right, the governor's office has called on all parties to settle. It may sound inconsistent with what I said I tried to get the governor to do last year. I think the governor should not just call on all parties to settle. I think they should call on Exxon to pay. So it's a difference between asking plaintiffs to start compromising and asking them to pay.
Okay, anything further? Thank you, Mr. McHugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and then the only other person I have online is Matt Jamin.
Good afternoon. This is Matt Jamin. I am one of the lawyers that represents the plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez litigation. On behalf of plaintiffs' counsel, we do support the resolution, and we think it is a very sensible resolution at this time. The suggestions thus far have been that there might be something deliberate that would affect the case, and certainly that's a possibility. But we are equally concerned that there might be something, given the attempts made in the federal legislature to change class action legislation, to change tort legislation, what's called tort reform, that there might be something that is not deliberate. And we think that the legislator's proposed resolution brings to everyone's attention the need to be wary as legislation is passed on the federal side so that it does not affect this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jamin. Any questions? Okay, hearing none, is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on House Joint Resolution number 9? Anybody else online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed on House HJR number 9. It brings it back before us. Is there a motion? Representative
Go ahead.
Anderson.
You haven't done one.
Representative Coghill.
We'll mix them up.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we pass House Joint Resolution number 9 out of committee with individual recommendations.
1-0.
1-0 fiscal note.
Any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, HJR 9 is moved. That brings us to, last but not least, House Bill number 150, licensing of radiologic technicians.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson, are you going to present it?
I am, part of it. And we have John Bittner here from my office who can also assist.
Why don't we do a motion to adopt the CS just as a work draft? Okay. Representative Guerra?
You'll go through that, John.
Chair, I would move that we adopt.
Hold on, I'm passing it up. You want to see what we're.
Just to adopt for discussion.
CS for House Bill 150. For discussion purposes.
The S version.
Yes, version.
Okay, is there any objection to that, just for the discussion purposes? Okay, hearing none, we have the new version before us. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 150 is a bill that has been evolving since probably the 1990s in terms of its concept. And the changes in amalgamation have occurred and been kind of in an evolving, growing nature, because I think every sponsor, myself and previous sponsors, have always wanted to work with rural Alaska and all parties that might be positively or adversely affected in this legislation. The bill will establish educational and certification standards for the healthcare personnel in Alaska who perform medical imaging and radiation procedures, radiologic technicians. Any radiology procedure is only as effective as the person performing that procedure. You've probably heard stories, there's certainly been some in Alaska and throughout the nation, where like an underexposed chest ray, x-ray can't reveal pneumonia, or a malignant lesion is overlooked because of improper radiologic procedures. And at the same time, mammography and procedures such as that, those techniques can't detect breast cancer and other diseases if the person operating the equipment does it inappropriately or inaccurately. No matter what the procedure, the radiologic technologist's knowledge of anatomy and the careful application of radiation and skillful operation of this equipment, which is really sophisticated ultimately, I think are the keys to the success. And to be clinically useful, diagnostic imaging exams must be accurate. And anybody, again, who goes in for a mammogram or for a chest x-ray when there's a broken bone would attest to that. 38 states have adopted recommendations for state licensure of radiology personnel. Alaska is not one of those states, and I think that's one of the reasons I offered the bill last legislature, and it didn't even move out of its first committee. And this year, finally, we have some good debate. Establishing state standards will ensure that Alaskans will have access to safe and high-quality radiologic care. Licensure will establish radiation protection measures as well as education and credentialing standards that will ensure the competency of persons operating medical equipment emitting radiation. And ultimately, to ensure that the citizens of the state of Alaska receive maximum protection from the harmful effects of excessive and improper exposure to radiation, this type of licensure must be passed to establish standards. Now I'm going to go away from my script, which I didn't read that well, unfortunately, but I really want to talk to the committee in closing for my introduction and say that this bill is critical, in my opinion, not just for the licensure sake for radiologic technicians, but for the safety of individuals in Alaska. And I think there are some arguments we'll get into, but first and foremost is looking at the national standard. When I look at bills, I say, what have other states adopted? Are we the first? Are we the second? That's not always compelling, because I think being the first can also be important as the precedential move for a legislature. But in this case, we would be the 39th state. Now, the second point is, and I see Representative Wilson here to testify, no doubt, and others either online or in the future as we go through this process will testify, hey, what about rural Alaska? What about rural Alaska, where there have been nurses and assistants in hospitals and small clinics that have been operating these machines without any problem? Conversely, and if it gets to the head where we have this debate ongoing, it's been ongoing for years now, and the bill hasn't, like I say, moved far until this year. Conversely, I can show you examples of over-radiated, under-radiated, misdiagnosed cases where I think that someone wasn't properly trained. And generally, it was due to this rural mindset that, hey, Joe Schmo has been operating this equipment and knows what they're doing, and I think wasn't adequately educated and trained. We have made, and my staff, John Bittner, will go through this, we have made numerous concessions on this legislation to the extent that we have opened the parameter and eased to get education, and John will go through that, to get the required education for certification. University of Alaska has worked with us, I think, in making the program easier to enroll in. And I think also with the inclusion of, I believe, nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, in past meetings, those folks have called in and we've said, wait a minute, you need to reread the bill, because the current version that we've adopted, we allow you to continue to operate this equipment. I think that the testimony from the Alaska Society of Radiological Technologists will be compelling to you, I hope. And I know that I think Barbara Huff is here. I don't know if she's still to testify regarding, the nurses and other folks that are involved with this, that actually do fall within the parameter and can continue to operate this equipment. I think it comes down to health. I think it comes down to the national standard. And I hope that you, in terms of this dialogue, listen to our arguments in support of the bill with an open mind on the rural exemptions, but recognizing that we don't want to kill the bill simply because there's folks in rural Alaska and super small communities that have been operating this equipment. I don't think you get a pass just because you've been doing it in the past if the threat of harm to the patient could occur. So with that being said, I don't know if, Madam Chair, if you want my staff to go through the changes in the CS, maybe that's better, and then we get so folks know what's going on.
And then I understand that Donna Ruffsalm is on the East Coast and has a time constraint, so I will accommodate her right at the top, and I know Barbara Huff-Tuckness also has a time constraint, so I'll get to you folks early on. Mr. Bittner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Bittner. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. I want to walk you real quick. You should have just handed out both a copy of the new CS and a memo that outlines the changes we made. It's an extremely long memo, but if you look closely, most of the changes were changing the word division to department. Division was mentioned throughout the bill. The Division of Alcohol Licensing asked us to make it broader to let the department decide where it goes. Ultimately, this will almost certainly be the Division of Occupational Licensing, but from a drafting perspective, it's unusual to single them out, which is why we made that change.
John, before you go on through the chair, once you're done with the analysis, if you could just briefly go through, I say concession, but I realize other folks want to testify and we have limited time, but maybe go through some of the changes that we've gone through from the original bill in terms of working, as I stated, with rural, you know, the rural folks that were interested. So the committee knows that. I mean, this has been a... We've been changing this steadily throughout the last 3 months.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, absolutely. As I go through these changes, I'll try to give you an idea of where they came from. Also, we have some people here who worked on previous versions in the former or the past legislature who will be able to tell you the changes we made at that juncture. just to start out, page 1, lines 4 through 5, we added a new section 1, which amends AS 8101-010. Basically, this includes the regulation of radiographers under that section, adding their licensing under the statutes that deal with powers of the department to regulate professions without boards. It was pointed out that since radiographers don't have their own board, there are certain ways that we can facilitate their oversight, and one of those is to add them into this chapter. Page 2, line 6, we removed, at the request of the dental board, we removed dental hygienists from subsection 2. It was felt that they were already covered under the definition of license under subsection 3, and they just felt for the sake of consistency to take them out would be a good idea. On page 2, lines 12, we added dentistry and dental hygiene under the lists of schools or colleges of medicine that get an exemption. This was made at the request of the Division of OC Licensing for the sake of consistency. The next... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Skip past the division.
The next seven changes are just division to department on pages 3 through 4. Page 4, line 11, we had the word current before certification. This was made to ensure that there wasn't any confusion about the intent of that particular section. We want you to be currently certified, and in case your certification is taken away, we don't want that to apply to you. Page 4, lines 21 to 23. This was a change we made in response to concerns from the rural providers. They felt that some of the people out in rural Alaska have been doing this for a very long time. They've been training themselves, getting training on their own, or they've gotten training previously in other states or countries. It was felt that they shouldn't have to go through the training all over again. We reached a compromise with them by saying if they can, for intents and purposes, test out basically of the requirements, then they would be fine. They would not have to go take the classes, which some people felt would be too onerous, too expensive. If you can prove that you have a working knowledge and you know the safety procedures, then absolutely you shouldn't have to go through it all over again. And so we made this change as a response to their concerns. The changes on page 5 and, for the most part, page 6 are division to department. If I can direct the committee's attention to page 6, line 7, this is another change we made in response to concerns from rural Alaska. Previous versions of this legislation said that you had to have been practicing without a license radiologic technology for 3 out of the past 5 years. They felt that this was another burden that they shouldn't have to bear. We agreed with them. Frankly, if you hire someone recently, there's no reason why they should be licensed, but there's also no reason why they shouldn't get a temporary permit so that they can continue practicing and doing their job while they're receiving the training. So this says that if you can prove that you practiced the 2 years preceding the effective date of this legislation, which you will notice is July 1st, 2007, then you are eligible for the temporary permit, which will allow them to continue practice. Let's see. Page 6, line 13, adds non-renewable before temporary permit. The reason we did this was to, once again, clarify the statute. This isn't something you can get again and again. You can't say that you are going to go to school and then just get a year after year after year of temporary permits. This is a one-time only to allow you to get the training you need to get your license. Division to department, is the next, for the rest of page 6. Page 7, lines 2 through 3, we rewrote subsection D to make the sponsors of the continuing education requirement to make them approvable by the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists. This was done because of the Division of Occupational Licensing felt that they weren't particularly qualified to make this judgment call, and they would prefer us to point them in the right direction of a professional organization who would be more familiar with the concerns and needs of radiologic technology. The ARRT very graciously stepped up and said that they already have the protocol in place. They have lists. They have, you know, they do this research already, so there's no reason why the division shouldn't go to them for this information. The next two changes are division to department. Let's see, page 7, line 13, we changed 24 months to 1 year. This was an oversight in drafting. This change was made to bring this statute into line with the other disciplinary statutes in the bill. In one place it said 1 year. In this particular section it said 2 years. We just basically evened it out to 1 year to make it consistent. And also adding page 7, line 14, adding the words, the department may require an examination for reinstatement to address concerns that people who have their licenses revoked and then reinstated may not be up on current procedures. Say it's been 10, 15, 20 years. You have to test out to prove that you're current on your knowledge of the radiologic technology. Page 7, line 24, we added a new subsection under the fees section. For adding an area of practice to an existing license. Line 25, for adding program approval under AS 889-130, which is an earlier section of the bill. This is made at the request of the Division of Occupational Licensing so that they can spread the fees for these particular services to the people that are requesting them and not to the general fee holders, the general licensees. For example, if a dozen programs asked to be admitted, you know, asked to become eligible for training radiologic technicians in Alaska, the cost of that shouldn't be, if they don't succeed in being accepted, the total cost of that shouldn't be passed directly onto the licensees. Frivolous claims and such would make their fees skyrocket. So this allows them to charge the people actually asking for the services as opposed to the licensees. Let's see. Page 8, we just changed division to department. Page 9, mostly division to department until line 28, adding we rewrote subsection C to bring the license suspension provisions under the administrative hearing codes. This was also done at the Division of Occupational Licensing's request. They felt that it was more in line with the way these things are normally done. Apparently this is similar situation. Similar occupations have this type of administrative hearing provisions in their statutory language, and we removed certain sections, particularly under definitions. We removed the definition of division since it's no longer referenced; it was unnecessary. Page 11, line 5. We changed the word. Excuse me. Radiologic technician with a radiographer. This was made at the direction of AART. Apparently that's the correct terminology as opposed to what we had. Other than that, it's mostly just drafting changes to reflect changes earlier on in the bill. Sorry for taking up so much of your time with that. But if you have any questions on the particular changes, I'm more than willing to answer them, or we have people in the audience who can speak further on the reasons for the changes.
And I would ask, Madam Chair, just because John was kind of the drafting technician, but the substance would have to really go to Donna. If someone's going to ask something real specific, it's just easier. It's, you know how these bills work. Someone comes and asks you to do the bill. It's better you ask her than John, if that's okay.
Representative Dolson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask my question, whoever the appropriate person to answer would be great. The change on page 7, line 14, where it says the department may require an examination for reinstatement. I'm wondering, you had expressed the reason for this being that someone might have been out for a length of time and they need new technology had been developed. So how is it determined if that person should take the test? Is there a length of time? Who makes that determination? And so I guess my question is, should it be may or should it be shall, and should there be a time frame in there?
The determination will be made through the chair. Sorry, Representative Dahlstrom. The determination will be made by the division or the department that this provisions eventually fall under. Our assumption is the Division of Occupational Licensing. They would determine what a length of time is. It's a minimum of 1 year. Say you reapply a year and a day after your license is revoked, chances are there's not a whole lot of major changes that would have happened in the radiologic technology system since then. Whether or not the cost of a test in that particular situation would be justified would be up to them. But like I said, for maybe a decade later, I don't know why you would wait that long. But just in case, it would definitely be up to them. And I think we have someone from the Division of Occupational Licensing online who would probably be able to give you more specifics.
Okay. I'm going to, Representative Wilson, if it's okay if you would yield your status, I would normally go to a member first. If it's okay if I could go to Donna for her time constraint, she's on the East Coast. So, is it Rufschalm? Rufschalm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Donna Rufschalm, and I'll introduce myself. I sit on the board of the Alaska Society of Radiologic Technologists, and I'm chair of the Licensure Committee of the Alaska Society of Radiologic Technologists, the writers of this bill. I'd like to go a little bit into the history of the bill. I won't bore you with all of it, but just for those who aren't familiar as to why we felt that this was really a necessary piece of legislation and what's happening on the national level. In 1981, Congress passed what they called the Consumer Patient Radiation Health and Safety Act of 1981, which established at that time minimum standards for state licensure personnel who administered ionizing radiation. Then that the whole intent of that act was to minimize unnecessary exposure to radiation. Now, 41 states have adopted licensure laws since then. I think Representative Anderson said 38, but up to now 41 states have adopted licensure laws. Alaska's not one of those, and there's actually legislation in Congress today, the CARE bill, that if passed would require all states to meet or exceed standards established by the federal government. And states that don't comply with the CARE bill would risk losing Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement for imaging procedures. So this is really important, you know, for us on the state level, if we can actually go ahead and establish some standards, things that we want to see in our legislation, you know, and get those passed and become law and start recognizing those standards, then the federal government would recognize them, and we would probably be just fine. We have a say in this. In other words, what I'm trying to say is we have the opportunity right now to establish standards for the state of Alaska. Otherwise, we would have to comply with whatever the federal government establishes. Why establish minimum standards for personnel who perform medical imaging procedures? Basically, it all boils down to quality, safety to the patient, the operator, and the cost. We all know that radiation is a carcinogen. Operators of medical X-ray equipment deliver the largest portion of man-made radiation to the general public. Radiation is safe if properly applied, but it can be harmful or even deadly if it's misadministered. And I think that's really important factor for everyone to recognize that radiation has been recognized as one of the leading carcinogens. Delays in diagnosis or misdiagnosis caused by poor imaging exams can drive up healthcare costs. Inaccurate diagnoses obviously can delay diagnosis of the inaccurate imaging can delay diagnosis. Accurate diagnosis depends on a good and useful medical image. The quality of medical imaging exam is only as good as the person performing it. Right now and today in Alaska, anyone can take x-rays. Anyone who's sitting on the committee floor right now could go into an office if someone would hire them and take x-rays without any training. We require hairdressers to be licensed, but it's pretty bizarre when we don't require people delivering radiation to patients to have any sort of licensing or educational requirements. And actually, there is a report that's just out, and a lot of you may not, some of the medical professional people may be familiar with this, but something called the Medical Payment Advisory Commission, which is an agency that advises Congress on healthcare policy, just recently issued a report on March 1st regarding what they called the overuse, underuse, and misuse of imaging services. And on March 17th of 2005, the House Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on Health conducted a hearing to address the MedPAC recommendations that Congress set standards for those who perform or interpret diagnostic imaging examinations. And I'll just a synopsis of the MedPAC report here. Medicare, basically what they stated was that Medicare has an interest in ensuring that imaging studies are done by skilled technical staff using appropriate equipment. And that the CMS, which is Medicare, should consider setting standards for at least the following areas: imaging equipment, qualifications of the technicians performing the studies, the technical quality of the images produced, and procedures for ensuring patient safety. So this is Medicare, and they're really going to be setting some guidelines and standards for those individuals who perform radiology procedures. With House Bill 150, we have recognized the fact that the rural areas of the state have different needs than what the urban areas do. And I think that in writing House Bill and working with the different groups around the state, we've tried to address those needs. We surely do not want those services to be discontinued. That's not the intent of the bill. We know that those services need to be there, especially in the very, very remote areas. It's really imperative that they be able to provide radiology services for patient care. And our concern is that we don't want to see those services discontinued, but we would like to see the people who deliver those services have some sort of training. And we've worked with the University of Alaska in Anchorage to provide an online course for those individuals. There are other online courses also available on the internet for individuals to receive a minimum of training so that they can protect themselves as well as the patient from unnecessary radiation. We've kept the cost down. We've made accommodations in the bill that John just mentioned, different accommodations, so that people who are currently taking x-rays can actually probably be tested out. They would be looked at for competency and would actually forego the program. They wouldn't have to participate in the program if they can prove competency. We've allowed a very excessive, what we feel is, I shouldn't say excessive, but a long period of time, a four-year period for individuals to be able to participate in the course if it was something that they would have to meet at that requirement. And we've also made accommodations that individuals who are new coming into the field would be able to take x-rays as they're taking the first module at the UAA so that they could go to work immediately as long as they had a mentor or someone working at the facility with them. So we're doing our best to try to meet all those needs and still recognizing the fact that people do need to be educated for their own safety and the safety of the public, which is what the whole intent of this bill is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Kira.
Madam Chair, I've got a number of questions on the bill, so I'll just go to somebody else if they have other questions they need to ask. Ms. Ruffshaw, this is Representative Les Guerra. Let me just summarize the sort of three of the questions that have come to my office from other people who have concerns about the bill, so I could let you address them. I distributed a memo to some of the other folks just so they could see sort of a sample email that our office has received. I'll go through them quick, and then I'll ask you the first question. One, I've heard people are concerned that even if UA does a or the University of Alaska does a course, it only has a certain number of slots available, and that all the people who need to take the test won't be able to get in to take the test. That's one. Another is that people are wondering what courses will qualify for the training requirements that are required in the bill. So we've heard that there are some out-of-state courses that might be able to be taken online. But I'm not exactly sure which ones will, if somebody takes them, will qualify them to be a radiological tech. And then there's a question, there's a number of exemptions. One of the emails that we received mentioned that There are exemptions for, you don't have to take the test if you're a dental assistant, you don't have to take the test if you're a physician's assistant, you don't have to take the test if you're a doctor. The comment that I received from one physician's assistant is that many of those licensed professionals don't really have any x-ray taking experience. So why, if the tests are so dangerous, why are we exempting them? And so I guess the first question then I'll go back to is, how can we, or should we feel comfortable that there are going to be enough of these courses locally or nationally that people can get the coursework done in time to, in the next, what, 2 years?
We've talked about that amongst ourselves as a committee and with other individuals, and we don't think it's going to be an issue. UAA is going to accommodate just as many people as they possibly can. They do have some limitations because they don't have, staffing is an issue, but they are going to continue on with the limited scope program. If the bill passes this year, it'll be 2007 before it'll be enacted, and there will still be an additional 2 years after that time for people to start getting their education, which means that from 4 years from the time, from say if it passes this year, July 1st, 2005, they would have 4 years. They'd have until 2009 to get their courses completed. And definitely UAA will be able to accommodate a large number of those people. The online courses available, what we're trying to, the whole program, UAA program, once they have completed the course, the state sends in the names to what we call the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, the ARRT, which as a courtesy to the states that have limited scope licensure, offers an examination that these individuals can take. That's what we would like to see these people take, the limited scope examination, which would then qualify them to be able to be considered limited scope radiographers. Online courses available through the internet or online also allow these individuals to sit for the ARRT examination. It would be the same thing. They complete their course. They show course completion to the department here in the state that would be handling the licensing. They would send their name into the ARRT saying these people are eligible to sit for the exam, and they'd sit. And those courses, I believe, Clyde Pierce has a little bit more information about them than I do, are ongoing all the time. I believe people can sign on at any particular time for the particular course. They don't have to wait for a semester to begin or end. And they are available, I believe, 12 months out of the year for anyone who wants to begin taking them.
Representative Garrett?
Thanks. So there are online courses that will qualify under this bill that are let me just go back. There's one comment in one of these emails that says they've been told that UA might only be able to take about 20 students a year, and so I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that. And then I've been told variously that this might take up to 3 semesters. I don't know if that's correct or not. So,
Erica White, who is the professor of the and over the radiology program at UAA, would better be able to answer the number of people that she'd be able to accommodate. I believe she was talking about 20 people beginning in the fall, in the fall semester, that she'd be able to accommodate for the limited scope program, only because it's a new program. They have a beta program going in Bethel to see how things are working. But as far as the time frame, it's 3 modules. The first module, they would like people to complete in a minimum of four weeks. The second and third modules can be completed at the same time. So, no, it's as far as the time frame goes, if they can run them concurrently, one right after the other, which is the way the program is designed, whether they have the staffing to do that or not is going to be the question. But if they could run them concurrently, people could theoretically be finished with the courses within, say, 8 to 12-week time period. The other online courses, I don't have a good feeling for their time frame as to when people would be expected to be able to complete them when they have a minimum time period. The rest of your question, I don't know if I answered all of it there for you. I apologize.
No, You answered a lot of it, and I'll just let other people ask questions. Those are my major ones for right now.
Questions?
I'll just to help her. And Donna, I know we're limited on time because of the committee's time frame and other folks want to testify. But just super quick, this is Tom Anderson, obviously sponsor, and I wanted to ask you a couple questions so the committee understands. First of all, Representative Guerra said, well, why then are physician assistants, per this correspondence from one of his constituents, why are physician assistants and physicians and nurse practitioners included if it's such a dire strait if someone messes up on an x-ray or other piece of equipment in terms of improperly using it? And what was the rationale there to include them?
They're actually exempted from the bill. I mean, they have their own boards and their own practice standards, and that's why they're exempted. I mean, they can actually take, as part of their own practice, be able to do radiology procedures, podiatrists, physicians, assistants, physicians, individual orthopedic doctors, chiropractors, dental assistants under the dental have their own board. The dental board oversees their practice and what they do. So they are exempted from House Bill 150 because of that.
And so through the chair, so it's your testimony that the point generally, the main spirit of the bill is that we want to have licensure, and if a physician is rogue or messes up in whatever hypothetical you want to give, or a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant, the list that you gave, they have a respective board that can cover that. And
correct.
Should this bill pass, if someone is out in wherever, Alaska, or in an urban setting, and they are not one of those, I think the committee understands, but I just want this kind of recorded, then they must be licensed through this new board, and to acquire that's what we've talked about. There's ample areas where they can get the education. And the exemptions are generally still tied to either if you're in a different profession, again, like a physician, and then you have your own board, and otherwise you would be covered.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And then the one last thing before we move on is with respect to rural Alaska, you know, the big issue, first I had physician assistants, and I don't remember the timeline, but they called in and they said, wait a minute, we're not included. And I don't know if that's accurate or not, but in any case, it's people know now, the members of the committee know they're included. And then we got into the folks in the dentistry, and we've included them. I mean, we've really made it expansive. Then we got into the issue in the beginning of the year of the education, and we tried to expand it. UAA said, we're willing to accommodate. We went down the line. Is there any other area, or do you think maybe refute you want to give from rural Alaska other than the fact that you feel that at some point we just have to debate the issue of should you be licensed or not? Is there any other salient issue that you can bring to the committee that we gave a concession on to have the current CS before us, or do you think we've covered most of the issues?
Well, the one thing that we really, as a committee, and we have just recently discussed and made a lot of accommodations for individuals, we were hearing concerns from not just the rural areas, but also the urban clinic settings and the small physicians' offices who might have people in their offices performing radiology procedures. They were concerned that if their individual that is currently working for them left tomorrow and they had to hire someone else to replace them, how could they still provide radiology or x-ray services without that person going through a formal program first? They did not want interruption in services just for the care of their patient. They wanted to make sure that they could provide the best care in the most timely manner possible. The way the UAA program is set up, they can begin the first module of the program, module number one, on day one. If, you know, providing, of course, that Erica has accommodations in the program, or they can sign on to an online course. But module number one can be completed while they are working. So as long as they have a mentor or someone who is overseeing them as they're performing x-ray procedures, they can start working right away
but they do have to start module number one of the program so that they do have a knowledge of radiation protection and safety for both themselves and the patient, and then would have to continue on with module number two. But again, the big thing there is that someone would have to oversee their job performance to make sure that for their own the patient's protection and the operator's protection that they were performing the procedures correctly.
Good. Thank you. Just a final statement, and I'm done. I just want to let folks know that, you know, this summer my son was biking on Muldoon Road and inadvertently went off the curb, landed on his arm. My dad was the first one to assist him and ultimately brought him to one of these, I won't say the name, but one of these quick care places. And the assistant did the x-ray and said, I'm almost positive that your arm is broken. My dad called me, said, Tim's got a broken arm. We're going to take him to Providence just to confirm. Went over to Providence. No, wasn't broken at all. Had a sling. Of course, my son freaked out thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to need a cast. Not the case whatsoever. Now, the ultimate, you know, in advance, we went decided to go to Providence to make sure that a radiologic technician, me having sponsored the spill 2 years ago and thinking about that, would actually perform that x-ray. But just for the committee's understanding, I think that that's an example, maybe not the biggest egregious case, but that's an example of how I think that if there was certification, the reading and the x-raying of which wouldn't have had to be redone and wouldn't have been misdiagnosed. So just one example that actually hit me, and it hit me post my sponsorship of the bill 3 years ago.
Representative Guerra?
I think the whole concept behind the bill makes sense. I mean, I support the concept, and I don't know what to do about some of these details. But if it was a physician's assistant who did that x-ray at that clinic, then they would have been exempted by this bill, right? The bill exempts anybody who has a license. So if you're a physician's assistant, and certain categories of nurses have licenses, any profession that has a license, even if you have no training in doing an x-ray, you don't have to get the license, you don't have to do the coursework. And I don't know if that was a physician's assessment that it wasn't.
I checked on it.
I just don't know what to do about that either.
Okay, Representative Wilson. Thank you for being patient.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have several things that I would like to go over with this bill. So I'd kind of like to kind of just go. I'll make my comments first, and then I'd like to go through the places in the bill that I have a question about. First of all, I am concerned about this bill making it a hardship for small businesses, and especially in rural areas. And the reason I talk from experience, because I worked in Tok for 4 years in a clinic. It's a very, very small clinic. There were only two nurses and a lab technician. We were trained, the two nurses and the lab technician were trained on how to use the x-ray machine, and but there were people that would come around checking quite often about how much radiation you had to wear a little something or other on you so that you could tell how many x-ray rays that you got yourself. If one of us was gone, we really needed more than one person to know, because if one was absent and wasn't there that day, there would have to be somebody else. It's not like that there was somebody that could come in and take your place. If you were gone, you worked with just two people that day instead of three people. So my concern is that the machines that we have, especially in rural areas across the state, many of them are older machines. And so if we say that they have to take the go to the schooling, well, I can guarantee you, I don't care how good the schooling is, you aren't going to learn how to do x-rays and all these various machines. They're all different. And the older they are, the more complex they are. So I am concerned, and I'll go over that when we get to the part of the bill about that, but I am concerned that just because someone is going to have an examination on to see if they know, they might know knowledge-wise in their heads how many I'm not sure of the correct terminology, but you know how much RADS that you can that depending on the situation, whether it's an arm or a leg, or your body, it, you have more dense material to go through, so you have to change the settings and everything. Well, the new modern machines that you have nowadays, you go in and it says, and I really would encourage everyone to go into your hospital and see what the x-ray machines are like. Many of them today, it goes, for an arm, you push that button. And then is it large, medium, or small? You push that button. And then is it for a child, a man, or an infant? You know, and you push that. And so it's totally different depending on how modern the x-ray machine was. Now, the one that we used in Tolk was the x-ray machine that survived the earthquake in Valdez. And they, because of insurance and everything, got a new machine. So, oh my goodness sakes, how wonderful. Now Tolk had a machine. Well, I can assure you that it was much more complicated to run that machine, the old machine. You had to do a lot of settings, you had to look, you had to think. It was so complicated that we would always verify it with each other to make sure we had all the settings right, because it wasn't any push-button thing like modern days is now. So if someone's going to demonstrate and take a test that doesn't even anywhere come close to know whether they can go back to where they're from and run that machine and know how to run it. So I think that's something that this probably doesn't cover. But so that's just one of them. So I think that that's something that we need to think about. The cost is quite prohibitive for some areas. For instance, it may be only up to $800 or $1,000 to take this course. I'm not sure how much it costs. Someone told me it was a little under $1,000. Well, if you have a clinic like Tolk that they have to provide that for their people, well, they run on a shoestring anyway. To provide the services in the area that they provide those services, it's really close. And they're barely getting by, but they want to keep it open because they want to serve the people in that area. There probably would be the three people in that clinic that would have to take this course. And that could make a big difference on their profit margin. So it does make a difference, definitely does make a difference in these areas. The cost, I mean, just because it's available and it can, and it doesn't mean that they'll be able to pay for those people to get it done. In Tolk, we actually had one other person that knew how to take the x-rays, and that was the chief EMT. And the chief EMT did it, and that saved the rest of us a lot, because when there was an emergency at night, I wouldn't have to get out of bed and come into the clinic just to give an x-ray, or the lab technician, depending. So in these little areas, this really does make a difference. It makes a huge difference. And I know that in the bush areas, I mean, Tolk is at least on the road system, but when you get into areas that aren't on the road system, it's much worse for them to be able to. They have a smaller clinic even than we do sometimes. So I think this is something that you just need to be aware of and to think about. They also talked about the ideal situations with the ideal x-ray equipment, and in the bush we don't have that. So please take that into account. I think this bill is very, very needed when it comes to radiation therapy. Now that's when people are given prolonged doses of this to the point where it's killing cells. And there is a very, very fine line there, how much you can give and without killing other tissue around it. What, you know, if it's your lungs, well, how far can you go and not destroy the lung? So I think in radiation therapy, this is extremely important, and so I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. But in the normal, everyday x-rays, it really makes a difference. And Representative Anderson, you mentioned that your son, they took the x-ray and didn't think that there was a problem, or thought there was a problem when there actually wasn't. Well, in many of these areas, and in most cases, even in the way up-to-date modern hospitals of today, the person that takes the x-ray is not the person that reads the x-ray. And so lots of times you have to send the x-rays on so that a doctor or a radiologist can read that x-ray. So even in the remote areas, the x-ray may be perfect, the development looks good, you can see things, but people that aren't taught how to read those x-rays can't always see things the same. This line looks like it could be a fracture, but it might be another line. It might be actually where a tendon is going along there. So, you know, just because somebody missed the diagnosis of the x-ray itself doesn't mean that the x-ray itself wasn't a good x-ray. So I just want to make that comment. My concern is, are we overreacting? Because I haven't seen a ration or heard, it hasn't come to my attention, that there's been a ration of problems with x-rays in this state all at once. I haven't heard that at all, and I actually haven't seen a list of any of the problems that have happened. Now, I don't know whether there's one problem that's happened that's started this, or whether there's 30. I don't know, but I have not seen a list at all, and I personally would like to see a list to see where the problems are coming from and what area they're coming from.
You know how much hair I used to have?
I'm walking through the x-ray at the airport. It's flying too much back and forth.
So, let's see. So I guess that's, I think I've kind of gone over, let's see, radiation paper. Okay, so I would like to go for a parts of the bill now, if you don't mind. I am
concerned that real quick, Peggy, just because we'll get lost in other. First, I want to make, I want to let you know, we'll make available to you testimony we've received from different people around the state about the problems they feel that there are. So you can look at those and decide if you think they're credible or not. And then the only other thing is, just before you move on to the other parts, you talked about radiation therapy, and you said that is a place where you'd draw the line and require licensing. And so right now, today in Alaska, it's not, there is no licensing required for radiation therapy.
I think it's just all.
All the same. Okay. And then the only other thing is, on that point, do you believe other areas that come to mind, and then I just want to hear your response, CAT scans, mammograms,
MRIs.
I want to know, is there any other thing that you would expand it to? I know you're the idea you're getting at, which is in the small health clinics or the medical offices, when you've got limited personnel, it may not be practical. But what are some of the other things? And because I really value your opinion as a healthcare professional, so.
I think that any time that you're doing something that's so all-inclusive, like an MRI, we don't have, I mean, that is so technical and so finite, you might say, that it's specialized. It's very, very specialized, and it's so expensive that only certain areas have them, and usually when you get the machine, the people that run the machine have to go for special training to run the machine. That's kind of the way that is. And so I would imagine they're covered, just because, even though they may or may not have to be licensed, but they have to have the training to go with the machine. I mean, so I think that for that reason, I'm not as concerned about that.
And CAT scans and mammographies, mammograms, same?
Yeah, they almost always, any time there is a machine like that, they train, people have to go way far, another state for the training usually to get it. Usually you can't even get it in Alaska.
Representative Kerr?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Peggy, for coming. I appreciate it, too. I wonder, I don't know if that's a way the bill should go, but one of the notes that I got made the same point that Representative McGuire asked you about, which is, they said, well, maybe x-rays don't submit somebody to very much radiation, and I don't know if that's true, but the others do, and maybe so you should license the others but not x-rays. And so do those other machines? Well, certainly radiation therapy exposes you to much more radiation, certainly nuclear medicine does, but do CAT scans and MRI machines expose you to more radiation?
You know, that's not my area. I mean, I really don't. I can't really answer that. I would assume, but I don't know that, so I'm not even going to try to go there because I'm not sure.
Just
one other question.
Try to get some answers on that. Representative Guerra?
One other question. There's the you're a registered nurse, and do you, so if we take this bill and we say, okay, anybody who's got a license, you're exempt from the bill. Let me just ask you about registered nurses. Did you receive, like, how to perform an X-ray training as part of your coursework?
No.
And we do have, Representative Anderson just told me, Clyde Pierce is on the line from the Department of Health and Social Services, who apparently is an expert in the technological aspects of this radiation.
Certifies the equipment.
So we can ask him that question, then Representative, Representative Wilson, please continue.
Thank you. And I'm sure, I'm not saying that that you couldn't give too many RADs or whatever the terminology is. I'm not even sure what the terminology is, but I'm sure you can give too much with a X-ray machine. But especially the more up-to-date, newer ones, it's pretty limited unless you push a bunch of the wrong buttons or something, you know. But I know that I've seen some where you either set a dial or you push a button. I mean, it's pretty, they're much safer than they used to be, let's put it that way. I have a concern about the licensed practitioner being, you know, I'm amazed because everybody assumes that, well, the licensed practitioner, which in this case would be the dentist or the doctor, that they would know how to do this. Well, many times they don't have a clue how to do it. They don't know how to run the X-ray machine. They don't know how to, you know, it's the staff that do it. The doctor writes, he says, oh, well, whoever their person is, I'll have Jenny give you an X-ray. The doctors don't do it. And to be honest, if you had them go in and say, show me how to do it, they wouldn't have a clue. So the safeguards are maybe false safeguards. Now, I know that there are some doctors that actually, maybe especially orthopedic doctors that maybe are around this all the time, they probably would go in and maybe know how to run their X-ray machine in their office. But believe me, most of them don't, you know. Where we were in Tok, we had a regular advanced nurse practitioner that was the licensed provider. Whenever that person was gone, we would have itinerant people come in. And believe me, they wouldn't have known how to run it. So I think this is kind of a false sense of security here, just a little.
Well, one thing you've also done, I think, is identified a distinction that I hadn't thought about, which we'll continue to follow up on, which is the distinction between the operation of the equipment and the potential effects of that to not only you as the operator or the receiver, but then the reading of the X-ray. And I don't know enough about the proposed licensure to know if the categories are distinct or if they're one, but you've actually made some really good, I mean, having been in the field, you've pointed out some real good distinctions that I hadn't thought of.
And I can give you an example. Even in Wrangell, where I live, and we have three doctors that work at the hospital all the time, all the X-rays, the X-rays are taken by a licensed radial technician, X-ray technician or whatever. Anyway, she would give them to the doctor. He will read them, and he says, well, it looks to me. But because he's not a licensed radiologist, he says, I think this looks like this is the situation. But they always send him to a certified radiologist. And so even MDs don't necessarily, they aren't experts at reading X-rays, and so they actually send them on to somebody else also. So.
Thank you so much.
And I've got more. I'm sorry. I'm sorry it's taken a while. But okay, so... Also, sometimes now, I don't know, on page 2, line 16, where it says the direct supervision of a licensed practitioner. Now, I don't know, but many times you are under the supervision, and maybe the word direct there is the key. But many times in remote areas, there may be somebody that's under the supervision of somebody that's in the next town, that they really are under their license and work under their license, but they're not in the same building even. So that's something you need to think, I wish you would think about. On page 4, line 22, or have demonstrated experience sufficient in the opinion of the department to waive the program. There again, how is the department going to come out to Tok and say, show me that you know how to run this machine? Or is the department going to say, tell me how to run it? And since the many, many, many different kinds of machines, how are they going to do this? So I think that's just another thing that you need to think about. Let's see. On page 7, well, I think I've covered that in some of my other comments. So on page 9, on line 28, where it says, within 7 days after the suspension order is issued. Well, in some of the areas across this state, they only get mail every other week. And so they might not even have gotten it since the date it was issued. And it might be 2 weeks before they get it, and it might be 2 weeks before they can respond back. So that 7 days, I think, is very unfair for some parts of the state.
And Representative Wilson, I've got about 25 people waiting.
And
If you've got more stuff, you could come back. That'd be fine. Thank you for your testimony.
Sorry,
I appreciate it. I am going to personally stay here until 3:30 to allow some of these folks that have been waiting so long to testify, but I understand if other members have commitments.
Yes. Representative Wilson like on page 12 the naming of the school program, the Peggy Wilson School of Radiology? If I could have that amendment, please. You look great today.
I love it. Pam LeBeau.
I understand Barbara is gone. She's left the building.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pam LeBeau, and I work for the Mulder Company, and we represent the radiologic technologists on this issue. And I just want to make one point. First of all, I would like to mention that some of Representative Wilson's questions regarding the machines, how they work, what the radiology exposure, radiation exposure is, and so forth, are Clyde Pierce is online and can answer every one of those. Secondly, I'd just like to make the point that you're not hearing from consumers on this bill. You may have noticed. That's because consumers believe, have been led to believe through experience, that anyone who delivers health care to them is trained, certified, and safety for the patient is utmost in their minds. We all believe that. Won't they be surprised when they find out that the people who are dealing with radiation, delivering doses of radiation to these patients, have no training? The other thing is that we expect food service workers to be trained. It's already been mentioned that beauticians, cosmetologists, barbers, 1,600 and some hours of training they have to go through to get licensed. I mean, if Barbara were here, she would tell you that truck drivers have to be licensed specifically to be able to drive those rigs that deliver things, products to the consumers down the highways.
Barbara Huff with the Teamsters.
Yes, excuse me, I should have mentioned that. Anyway, the point being that I think that when the public finds out that everybody except the people who deliver a potentially lethal dose of radiation to a patient doesn't have to have one iota of training. And that's the point I'd like you to keep in mind.
Thank you, Ms. LeBeau. Representative Kira?
Very briefly, Ms. LeBeau. It's just that I just hear it both ways, right? I mean, on one hand, I hear the machines can be dangerous, and you mentioned sort of a potentially lethal dose of radiation. But on the other hand, the people who are being exempted, like the dental assistants, when I've asked, when I've had 6 x-rays taken of my head, they've said, don't worry, there's like almost no radiation. So I don't know.
Through the
Maybe
chair.
That's for the person.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. First of all, I believe Clyde Pierce can answer that, and it's my understanding that the radiation dosage is very low and very regulated in that for dental assistants. Also, the whole concept is they have their own board, their own proficiency testing that they have to pass, so that it is considered that they are already trained in that. Now, you asked Representative Wilson if she had any training. Nurses aren't exempt in this bill. Nurse practitioners are, but nurses aren't. Nurse practitioners have training. Nurses don't.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Clyde Pierce. Mr. Pierce, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now.
Okay, this is Clyde Pierce from the Department of Health, and I want to say at the outset that the Department of Health, the department supports the bill and also hopes that the concerns raised by small and rural providers can be addressed. I'm trying to go backward here and see which specific question you're asking about, but from what I understand here, the concern is why are people in the healthcare field who've been identified as not being trained exempt from this bill while other operators are not? And I agree, that is a concern. And I also know that PAs, for example, have to do everything through their physician, their collaborative physician, who is licensed through the Board of Medicine in Alaska. And when they're licensed to practice medicine, they're licensed to practice it in all of its various aspects. But the PA must report to a physician in doing that. And if the PA is actually doing x-rays, and then the collaborative physician should have good reason to be concerned, but that's not the purpose of this bill, as I understand it. This bill is to address the fact that if you do have a situation where there is no one trained, you do have a serious problem, but from the time the patient enters until they are worked up and a decision is made to do an x-ray and the x-ray is done and then the x-ray is read, there ought to be at least one person in that chain of healthcare service who does know what they're doing. So this bill, as I understand it, is not trying to usurp any existing board like that licenses PAs or ANPs or physicians. It's simply trying to address that at least one person in that chain of service ought to know what they're doing when they're exposing humans and, you know, babies and women to radiation.
One of the things, Mr. Pierce, that has come up is, you know, radiation levels, I guess, and, you know, how do you compare radiation levels in a standard x-ray, say for a broken arm or something in an office, to those levels that come into play when you're talking about MRIs, CAT scans, or mammograms? And so people referred to you as somebody who might have some expertise about that.
Well, of course, in my position with the state, I do measurements on all these different kinds of machines, and I see quite a bit of difference. The problem is that it's not just the output capability of the machine that we need to be concerned about, it's how the machine is used. And I like to use the example of a driver of an automobile. When you look at the automobile with seat belts and safety bags and tinted windshields and power brakes and steering and all of this kind of safety features, why is it that 40,000 people die every year? It's because of how it's used. And when I do inspections, I actually rarely find a problem with the machine, even though I find many problems with how it's used. I was in Fairbanks recently, and 42% of the repeated films were due to positioning. Now, that's not something you normally even cover in a radiation safety course, but the person doing the x-rays had no knowledge of topographic anatomy, and so they didn't know exactly where internal structures were, and they were guessing with the positioning, and 42% of the errors and the repeats were due to that. So there is a real concern there about excessive exposures due to how the equipment's used. But in terms of procedures in general, we have the routine films, plain film, abdomen, chest, skull x-ray. There's a certain amount of radiation there, and we could think of that as a unit of one, whatever it might be. When you look at a CT scanner, the exposure level can increase substantially. However, there are some real diagnostic advantages to a CT scanner, and also earlier treatment can be critical in saving a patient. When you look at bone densitometers, exposures are very low. Nuclear medicine, surprisingly, I heard the testimony that it's one of the high exposures. Actually, many of the nuclear medicine procedures, even though you're injecting radioactive material in the patient receives less exposure than a corresponding dental or a medical x-ray exam. But all that aside, as far as the comparison, it depends on how they're used. So in the statistics that have published recently, and there's a lot of recent research that causes a lot of concern about diagnostic levels of x-rays. One of those shows about a 1% rate of all cancers in the U.S. are due to diagnostic x-rays. Another one was showing a diminished intellectual capacity as a result of the very young being exposed to levels, diagnostic levels of radiation. Now, these are in the upper level of CAT scan. However, in my experience in certain areas of Alaska, I have seen those levels exceeded by ordinary radiography simply because of how the equipment was used. And I agree with your former person that that the older machines do present a special challenge. Newer machines don't guarantee a lower dose. In fact, there are concerns about the doses getting higher. But the older machines, in my opinion, require even better foundation in the principles of how to use them safely. And that's my perspective.
Representative Garrett?
Thanks. Mr. Pierce?
Yes.
This is Representative Les Guerra. I've got a couple questions about sort of x-ray radiation exposure.
Yes, sir.
I was hoping your testimony was going to be that the new x-ray machines don't really present any danger of any radiation danger from a health perspective, but in your view, do the new x-ray machines then, I guess if they're improperly applied, do present some health risk?
Anytime you're using radiation, there is a risk, and the physician is trying to balance the benefit versus the risk. The newer machines have the potential to give you less exposure than the older methods, and when they're used properly, they result in a lower exposure. However, because they are electronic, computed, and digital radiography, they also have the potential to give you a higher exposure. And one of my concerns as an inspector is that when I go into a facility and I see a film that's obviously overexposed, the operator sees immediately, well, I used too much radiation, so they adjust their technique when they repeat it. With a digital kind of system, you can make serious errors in exposure, and the machine will compensate. And so the exposure to the patient can be increasing, and the operator is not even aware of it.
There was sort of an anecdotal comment in one of the emails I received that the new x-ray machines don't produce any more radiation than the x-ray machines you walk through at an airport. What would you say about that?
Well, that's of course not true. We're talking about medical x-ray equipment in the HB 150, where you are deliberately exposing patients, and we're also talking about a much larger beam and a lot of scatter from the patient, which does expose the operator. The national survey that showed three times the rate of breast cancer among operators of equipment shows that this is more than just a concern about patients alone, and these exposures are much higher. I actually inspected the baggage units at all the airports in Alaska prior to TSA taking over, and those exposures are very low. Even if you were to go through the machine, which is a dumb idea, but if you went through the machine, the exposure you would get at a baggage unit is considerably smaller than any diagnostic x-ray. And of course, now they have some CT units that are used to check baggage. And that's another matter. That would be a little more difficult to put yourself through that machine.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Pierce. That was useful. I might give you a call at some point and to ask you some more questions. That I guess you've sort of made it harder for. I was thinking about this compromise approach to say that you don't have to get the license to use one of the newer x-ray machines because they don't produce very much exposure. You just have to get the license for higher exposure things, but now you have me concerned that that approach might not work. So,
I do have a concern as a radiation inspector that the fact that this may conceal the exposures and actually allow even higher exposures to occur. And I would welcome you to call me, and I would even invite you to participate in an inspection if you're in the area where I am inspecting, and you can see the process, what I look at, how I evaluate the results, and maybe that would provide some more insight as to why we're concerned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Hall, are you online?
Hi, actually, it's Physician Assistant Hall. I've been listening in, and I do appreciate the, first of all, for the record, I'm sorry, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for hearing my name is Ed Hall, and I'm a physician assistant here in Alaska, and I serve as the legislative liaison to the Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants. And a lot has been said of what I was going to testify on, so I won't be redundant because I think some pertinent questions have been raised that have made this bill somewhat of a concern to us. Primarily, when this bill this year was first starting to be heard, there was the perception that the PAs were waffling on our support or non-support of this bill, as it were. Then there were some changes made, yes, and indeed there was a task force that was put together last fall. That's where the idea, the concept of putting nurse practitioners and PA, including this in the exempt providers section, would make it more palatable to us. But primarily what physician assistants are concerned about is access to care. And when this bill came up, we always questioned, just as Representative Wilson had said, you know, where are the problems here? You know, because we hadn't heard of any cases, and there's a lot of accusations about people using this equipment without any training. And personally, I know in my clinic, so I can take issue with it on a personal basis, but certainly talking to my colleagues, and not just my PA colleagues, I'm talking about other mid-levels, nurse practitioners, and doctors who PAs work under the supervision of, we give, certainly, we don't just pull people off the street and point them to the x-ray machine and say, go start shooting x-rays. There's a guidebook out that addresses anatomy. We make sure that people have an understanding of anatomy. Most of the clinics that I know of who are using techs, quote unquote, to shoot their films they're either a community health aide or somebody who has had some exposure to anatomy, gross anatomy. And then there is a text that shows positioning. And then, yes, in answer to Representative Wilson's comment about the type of machinery that is out there, it is much easier nowadays to use and have the technique of a certain exposure that one would need to use. So I would like everybody to recognize that this is just not blindly giving authority to anybody to shoot x-rays. They do have some training. As far as training goes, I know particularly in the PA programs that I'm aware of and several of the medical school programs that I'm aware of, there is not a specific course on how to shoot x-rays. But there are courses on reading radiography. And so you indirectly, sometimes you may get some knowledge about shooting x-rays. But yes, I think if this bill is directed at safety, and I'm shooting myself in the foot here, I understand it a little bit. But if it's about safety, then you probably shouldn't exempt any provider because it is not, even though we do have a licensing board that oversees us, it is not within most of our training to know how to shoot x-rays. This is all knowledge that is acquired once we get into certain situations. In my clinic, I've got two nurses and myself who shoot x-rays. And one of my nurses has been through the training at the Native Medical Center, and she basically trained the other nurse and myself as far as the appropriate techniques and positioning and all the important things that we do to try to keep things safe. I am happy to see the changes that Representative Anderson and his staff have incorporated. However, I think that this bill would be best if they could separate out basic radiography from the other procedures such as MRI and CT testing and things where you have to inject. I think all of those things definitely need to have some certification. And lastly, in regards to that certification, there has been talk about if we have a licensing board that we respond to or that we are accountable to, nurses have a licensing board and nurse practitioners are... their level is above nursing as far as treating medicine, but they all answer to the nursing board, and so the question has to be raised: can they then be exempt because they're under a different licensing board? And then can a CNA, who also is a licensee of the nursing board, should they be exempt too? I mean, so that's, I think the more we talk about this bill, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. But I think it's heading in the right direction personally, and I think professionally around the state, I think it's heading in the right direction. But I still think that there's limitations that's going to make this very costly for medicine in Alaska.
And just because 42 other states do it is not a good cause for us to do it if we are interested in access to care. Thank you for your time, and I'll stay online if anybody has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Questions? Does Mr. Hall represent? Physician Assistance Association. Okay, Mr. Ron Deese.
Yes, ma'am. my name is Ron Deese, and I'm here to testify as an individual, not representing any particular place where I work or anything like that. But I'll give you a little background. I came up here in 1982 to manage a radiology department, and my background before that was in teaching radiologic technology at a university. Shortly after I arrived, I started getting many calls from the Anchorage community from individuals asking for my help in terms of having them learn more about taking x-rays, and usually their request was fairly common. They were hired at a office, and surprisingly they were told they were going to take x-rays. They had no knowledge of x-rays, and many of them said, well, I repeated something 5, 6, 7 times and I couldn't get it right, and I need some help. And so I approached the University of Alaska, and we started an evening introduction to radiography course, and I've been teaching that course every year for 18 years. I also teach a course at the Alaska Native Medical Center for the last 9 years to PAs and nurse practitioners and community health aides, and that's been quite successful. But I just want to emphasize what Mr. Pierce said, that I still run across persons that have been hired to work in an office or a clinic that have no training whatsoever, and they're told they need to take x-rays. Oftentimes they repeat x-rays multiple times trying to get something that approximates an x-ray. So when we actually, you know, see an x-ray in a medical facility from one of these places for the radiologist to read, and we get an acceptable radiograph to look at, there's no indication of how many times that radiograph has been repeated. As a person that's very familiar with this state and the radiology procedures within the state, I think that the state needs to know who is administering ionizing radiation, and I think that the state needs to know that they have some minimum educational and clinical standards. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deese. Questions? Okay, Miss Huff Tuckness. She's come back. You've got the diehards here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Barbara Huff Tuckness. I'm the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I would like to go on record today supporting House Bill 150. I was not privy to all of the earlier testimony. I was here when Donna was testifying earlier, and of course I don't want to go in and repeat a lot of that testimony. From the Teamsters' perspective, we support our members that work in this particular industry. South Peninsula Hospital and Kodiak Island are the two key areas. South Peninsula Hospital, which is a small community hospital, does require the radiologic technologist to be registered or certified. I was actually quite surprised, Madam Chair, a couple years ago when I found out that this was not a state requirement. And I did bring with me a copy of, and I will leave both of these documents. I didn't bring enough for everybody. But I brought a job description for a certified nursing assistant. And the certified nursing assistant as well as our phlebotomist, both of which have to be certified by the state. Now, our nursing assistants work in two areas of the hospital in Homer, the acute care side and long-term care. Long-term care, their major responsibilities are bathing the patient or the residents there, taking their meals, making sure that their day-to-day needs are met. And these individuals, and not that I denote or sit here and testify denoting the skill and expertise of that work, but they are required to be certified, to be hired, and as a nurse's assistant, and this is statewide. Whether you are in a rural community or an urban community, I would like to expect that the same level of care, the same qualifications of these individuals would be taken into consideration. When we have a truck driver that hauls services or goods from Anchorage into, say, the rural community, they still have to have that certified driver's license. Our truck drivers also have to be certified. They do not touch people. They haul goods and services around. And not to, I guess, demean that type of work as well. Our phlebotomists also have to be certified. And I just wanted to read into the record the requirement on this certified nursing assistant, if I may, Madam Chair. Must be at least 18 years of age, must possess a high school diploma or GED, must have successfully completed a certified nursing assistant class, be certified by the state of Alaska, and maintain the certification on a biannual basis. Must keep current CEUs, continuing education unit credits, as required by the state of Alaska, maintains a BLS certification, demonstrates the ability to lift up to 50 pounds without self-injury, as well as ability to walk and stand for prolonged periods of time and perform duties that include bending, reaching, stooping, twisting while positioning or otherwise attending to patient care routine needs. That is our certified nurse's aide. Now, these are radiologic technologists, and I think for a lot of folks, and maybe there's been previous testimony, a lot of people believe that it's just x-rays, mammograms. I mean, I have become aware of this issue every time I go in, whether it's an x-ray for my broken arm or for my mammogram, I'm asking if these people are certified. And I do not believe that the public in general realizes the degree and the type of work that these individuals are performing. And I think that the bill has been modified. While we supported the original version of the bill, I think that there have been some somewhat reasonable compromises. There are probably some areas that I would say we've probably gone a little bit too far the other direction. But having something on the books and moving in the right direction, I think, both from an employee perspective working in the industry as well as a public health safety issue, I would encourage the committee to move the bill forward.
Thank you very much. And if you'd leave those with Vanessa, I'll make copies to get to them. Okay, thank you very much. I'm just, Representative Gary, you're free to go if you want. I'm going to just finish it out.
How many more do we have?
We have about eight more. Okay. So next, B.J. Anderson with the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Association. Are you there, Mr. Anderson?
Ma'am, can you hear me?
Ms. Anderson, my apologies. Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, very good. Thank you. My name is B.J. Anderson. I work for Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. I am the x-ray manager for the clinic here in Anchorage at the Fairview Center. I first of all would like to speak specifically to the wording of the bill in regards to a temporary permit, because I believe we have been led to believe that a person that wants to begin training to get a limited license, they just need to be able to be enrolled into a program, and then they can begin working under the mentorship of someone else. But that is not what the temporary permit wording is under Section 08.89.170. If you look at 4A, no, not 4A, I'm sorry. If you look at section 08.89170, number 1, it says that the person must have completed a program, and number 2 indicates that they must have taken an examination. And so I just think that the wording of the bill needs to be changed to reflect that once a person is enrolled in a training program and they have a mentor that will oversee their work, that they can be begin working under a temporary permit. I also would like to say that using mammography as an example for the kinds of x-rays that are being taken throughout the state is inappropriate because, for one thing, mammography technicians are already certified by the ARRT. They are already working under the umbrella of the FDA MQSA program and ACR certification. They have to have that certification in order to perform mammography in the state. And so there should be no technicians without this certification doing mammography in the state already. You know, any clinician or clinic has a huge liability providing healthcare services. And in the past, they have taken that seriously by using a mentoring approach to teach staff how to safely perform radiologic procedures. And so I think this is one of the reasons why this is a very difficult bill, in that we're requiring certification, but we're forgetting that in the rural areas, they are drawing people from the community and teaching them on-the-job training how to perform x-ray radiologic examinations. And they have, I would say for the most part, most clinicians and clinics are very conscientious about that. Perhaps, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but I think that if this bill goes through, it definitely needs to make allowances for that mentoring type of approach to continue, as well as the professional training that they could get through UAA. I don't believe that this bill is ready to progress until some of these changes have been implemented. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Representative Kira.
Thanks, Ms. Anderson. This is Les Garris speaking. How many, can you give me an estimate of how many hours of on-the-job training you give to somebody before they can use an x-ray machine?
You know, that is hard to say, because for one thing, you bring a person into your department and you might teach them how to process films one day, and then you give them books to look at about the skeleton and things like that.
We can't hear you anymore. You just cut off, Ms. Anderson. Did you maybe accidentally push the mute button, Ms. Anderson? Ms. Anderson, are you there?
Hello.
Okay. Yeah. You just cut off there when you were talking about the training.
Okay. You know, I am not a certified radiologic technician myself. I just manage our radiology department, although I do have a certified technician and I have a technician that is not certified but that had formal training. So it really depends on the person coming into your department how much training that they would actually need. You know, if I was training someone from the ground up, though, I'd be looking for an educational program to put them into, just like what UAA is proposing, because I really believe training is important. But, you know, the mentoring part, you just start hands-on teaching a person step-by-step the things that they need to know to perform the job and you give them tools, textbooks, and other things that they can look at in their spare time.
Does that answer your question? Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Okay, next I'm going to go to Beth Little Terry.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Beth Little Terry, and I'm with the Sunshine Community Health Center located in Talkeetna. And I'm actually going to testify on behalf of our executive director who couldn't, was not able to be here today. Her name is Susan Mason Bowders. And she, as I stated, is the executive director of the Sunshine Community Health Center located in Talkeetna. I'm going to read a little statement that she did prepare, that she is testifying in opposition to House Bill 150. The Sunshine Community Health Center is a federally qualified health center serving the Upper Susitna Valley. We serve a population of about 6,000 people, including a significant number of visitors to our state with the tourism activities in this particular area. We are located 70 miles from the nearest hospital in Palmer. Our after-hours care is a significant part of our practice. Our provider staff includes one family practice physician, three physician assistants, and two nurse practitioners. We offer digital radiology at our center and have a contract with Alaska Imaging Associates to provide our radiology reads, which we are able to do through teleradiology. We're able to obtain stat reads. Our normal run turnaround time is about 48 hours. In the past year, we performed a total of 52 x-rays, the majority of which were of extremities. We also perform a number of chest x-rays. Our x-rays are performed by either our providers or medical assistants. We do not require our medical assistants to be licensed radiology technicians. We do, however, provide thorough hands-on training for our medical assistants, including the areas of patient and practitioner safety, positioning, equipment operation, and maintenance. And none of our medical assistants perform x-rays without the provider being assured they are competent and fully qualified. I do not oppose this bill in its proposed purpose, which is to ensure quality of care for the patients. However, I do not believe that simply requiring licensure will ensure that purpose is achieved, and the very likely impact of this bill is reduced access to care for people in rural parts of Alaska and for people who are already challenged in accessing health care, those without insurance. In a rural health care center such as ours, we often are the first point of contact for individuals seeking health care. Being able to offer radiology services provides the following: an opportunity to catch severe and life-threatening diagnosis early, ensuring that uninsured patients will follow through with specialty care such as orthopedic referrals, and a reduced costly emergency transports and admissions through the emergency room. I would like to give you a couple of real-life examples of how our ability to offer radiology provides immense benefits to our patients. We provided a chest x-ray for a patient that revealed lung carcinoma in an elderly gentleman in our community. He was not willing to see a specialist or pursue any type of referral for treatment. The diagnosis of the cancer is allowing our staff to explore options with him and is allowing him and his family to prepare for the difficult and challenging times ahead. Another example I have is a woman that called our after-hour services. She had fallen and needed x-rays. Unfortunately, our x-ray was down at that time and she did not follow up and go to the hospital for x-ray. She also didn't come back when we called her the following week to have her come in for x-rays once our equipment was functional. She then called us 3 weeks later complaining of pain and was x-rayed at that time. Unfortunately, her treatment course by that time was much more complex and painful due to her delay in seeking care. The bones were fractured and had begun to heal unaligned and had to be rebroken and reset with resultant poor outcome that should have been. This bill, though intended to improve quality of care and ensure safety, actually could severely curtail access to care. It could very likely have the effect of making radiology the sole domain for a privileged few, mostly urban sites. With the ever-increasing cost of health care, I would prefer to see legislation that reduces barriers to care rather than increasing them. If ensuring quality is truly the goal of this proposed legislation, then requiring continuing education and periodic proficiency testing of non-licensed personnel seems to be a much more effective way to ensure quality and safety without reducing access to care. Thank you for your consideration of this testimony and allowing me to read this prepared statement by our executive director.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank
Questions?
You.
Okay, Mr. Fred Pike.
This is Dr. Weaver. I'm the medical director for Chemai Community Health Center here in Naknek, Alaska.
Okay.
I'm here to testify for the Bristol Bay Borough, who is the owner of the clinic.
Okay.
I've been the medical director for Chemai Clinic since 1990, and I'm opposed to House Bill 150 as it is. I believe having licensed radiological technologists at our clinic will not significantly increase safety, raise the standard of care, or improve security of diagnosis in our setting. I understand that bad things happen and that people can be damaged by people that do things wrong. We have always trained our people. I think it always has been incumbent upon the primary care providers to oversee the quality of the films that are read. Radiologists read them as well as oversight. Even though Clyde says that there are people that are getting radiated, I'm sure that may be happening, but I think passing a bill does not change that necessarily. For example, chest x-ray is touted to have the radiation equivalent to one day's sunlight. In a limited scope clinic, I don't believe that the amount of radiation, even though there may have to be a few repeats, is carcinogenic. I don't think that there's any evidence presented that extremity films and skull films and spine films produce enough radiation for carcinogenic, and in fact, Clyde says in the CT realm, I don't think anyone argues against the fact that CT, MRI, mammography, arteriography, and a multiple of other radiation therapy all should be heavily governed and do have risk. I believe that simple scope procedures done in rural areas, the benefit far outweighs the risk and the cost that may actually obstruct. We're the largest wild salmon fishery in the world here, and we see a lot of trauma. And in fact, our population may grow from, say, 1,200 to well over 10,000 in the summertime. Many of those, as most Alaskans know, the fishing industry is dangerous and has a lot of injuries. I heard a certain amount of anecdotal stories where people's lives have been saved by radiology, and I can voice that this is true. I can give you any number of cases where that happened. For example, someone with a pneumothorax, which means a ruptured lung, if that diagnosis is not made here and a chest tube placed, the person will die before you. We're approximately 289 air miles from Anchorage, which is a tertiary care. So stabilization and radiology go hand in hand for trauma cases, and I think it's important that we maintain that. I think that having radiologic technologists will not improve that situation. And in fact, we have tried to recruit registered technologists out here, and we usually get the guffaw, mean go to rural Alaska. I don't think so. So, we need to face reality here and do the best we can. Obviously, patients need to be safe. I don't think that giving the American Radiologic Technologists Association the responsibility for how we do x-rays in rural Alaska is helpful. No one's arguing against more complex procedures. I think that the other thing that would happen is if we're not able to use in-house people to do the radiology, it will cost us approximately twice the amount of money it would cost to operate. This would probably mean that we would have to cut back our services. We're down at currently at 24-hour, 24/7, 365-day operation here. That we have no other hospital facility nearby for us to. We're barely able to keep our doors open with the amount of technology that we have. We are a community health center, which is funded through the same federal grants that the Sunshine Clinic in Talkeetna is. I think that if patient, we have to think about the cost to the patients. If patients have to go to Anchorage, Providence, Alaska Regional AMC for X-ray, simple X-ray procedures, this will cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. That doesn't mean that they can't be safe with what we do here, but passing the bill will not improve that percentage.
Did you hear earlier the testimony about compromise?
You're breaking up.
Yeah, you're breaking up too. I'll let it go. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Okay.
You're welcome.
Karen Sagerstorm?
Yes?
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, my name is Karen Sagerstrom. I'm the Director of Village Health Services at Norton Sound Healthcare in Nome, Alaska. By training, I'm an advanced family nurse practitioner, and I'd like to go on record as being in opposition of this bill as it stands right now. We are currently in the process of introducing radiology equipment in our area. We have one machine that is currently in use, and we have three more that we'll be bringing online in the next several years. Anytime new technology is introduced, obviously training has to take place so that the equipment can be operated safely for the patient and the operator. Currently, we have a PA who's been doing x-rays over a number of years, and he's the one that's been operating the machine. We now have a CHAP who's learning to be to take x-rays. We sent her to the class offered by Ron Deese, along with another mid-level, the class at AMC, and now they're back in Unalakleet working in the tutelage of the other PA and learning how to take x-rays. In the villages, number one, as far as the bush goes, we're basically going to be doing simple films. The idea of mammography, that only takes place in Nome, and there is a licensed, registered technician who simply does mammography. As far as radiation treatment, MRI, CT, none of that even exists for Nome, let alone is it ever going to exist in a village. Potentially, we're looking at a CT eventually here in Nome, and that person who would come in would operate that, have all the licensure and everything needed. I'm speaking in this portion of the bill to only the people who take limited radiology. What we did in order to get this person online was started looking at writing policies and procedures, and we already limited their scope of practice currently, as it also would be in the bill, as listed, that they would only take radiology of the chest, abdomen, and the axilla, appendicular skeleton. And that's basically what I would have them do out in this area. We're not looking to have them do any more than that. Also learning how to operate the new digital equipment. I went online trying to find information about the class that's taught at UAA, and I cannot locate any information to be able to download exactly what's included in that class, except for the first credit hours are anatomy and physiology. The second portion of the class, the classes that can be taken, section 2 and 3, can be taken concurrently. I can't find any information about it. I've requested information. I've not received any, and I have great hesitation about being approved for that class, and we can't even find out exactly what's being taught in it. One of the things also that would make it a great hardship is in this bill, in section 08.89.160, it says for the limited person that they have to have a certain amount of the clinical instruction
is hands-on experience in a healthcare setting under the direct supervision of a practitioner or a fully licensed radiological technologist. I have a problem with that because if we have to, I don't know how many hours are involved in that. There would obviously be a certain number of hours that we would need to be able to train that person in NOAM, but also we have a limited number of x-ray procedures that are going to take place. If they have to do, I don't know if it's 50 to 100 direct x-rays, how long is that person going to be have to out of their villages here in NOAM getting x-rays? Is there a place that we can send it to ANMC? What creatively can we do to get that person in, get the training that they need to safely do the procedures, but not be out of their village for X number of weeks to months while obtaining that, because the CHAPs are the direct care providers. So I agree with the idea that there has to be training, but how can we make it more bush-friendly to get that training without making it an extreme hardship on the people who are here in the bush? Also, with the CME, how does that relate in specifically for the CHAPs? When they're doing a limited amount of CME, is that CME going to be written for them as applicable to their practice? That's one of the questions I have that's not really addressed here. So there's a number of issues. While I agree of the area of needing the training, there's a number of specific issues that's not been adequately addressed for the bush and could potentially make a real hardship for us to try to meet this bill as it stands.
Thank you, Ms. Sagerstrom. If you, I'm going to give you the fax number here. It's 907-465-6592. And any suggestions that you have by way of how to define the educational program or the mentoring would be appreciated. If you agree with the goal, which I will take you at your word, and I will take the other people who have said, I agree that we need standards, I agree that we need safety and regulation, then I'm going to call on you to help look at some of the specifics of that, because frankly what happened last year with this bill was that the same concerns were brought up and the sponsor of the bill said, okay, we'll go ahead and work on it in the interim, and the sponsor worked in the interim and made a series of compromises, including the temporary permit and the testing for those who had already been in the field. But every time it seems like the marker gets moved further. And so if, you know, other than saying anybody who's in a rural area doesn't have to comply with these licensing procedures requirements, I need to know some specifics about what we could do, because it sounds like you're going a long way at your clinic to make sure that the folks that are using radiological equipment are trained. And I hear your concerns in that you don't want to be in these little areas denied a temporary permit or a license based on these technicalities, and we don't want to make it overly onerous, but if we're going to require some standards and some licensure in this area, I need your help. So I would appreciate, I know you've got a lot to do, I know you're busy taking care of people, but if you get time, even if it's just in handwritten form on a piece of notebook paper, if you could write down some suggestions for us here in House Judiciary about what the programs could be. We heard reference to some internet programs wherein folks in rural communities could take these classes online and be taking them over a period of time. You know, those types of things, I'd be really appreciative.
Well, am I back online now?
Yes.
Yes. One of the things that we have is the CHAP directors, which is the community health aid practitioners. It's a group of directors that oversee the Bush clinics. We're meeting in May, and this is something I can bring back to them and ask them for ideas and input, and then turn around and give information and feedback as to what they think is possible.
That would be outstanding.
They think would be a practical, and that's representation basically from clear across the state.
That's outstanding. You know, and I'm going to suggest to the sponsor, I mean, he might think about you know, getting together with you guys. I'm sure he's been working with a bunch of people, but to work with you on an individualized basis. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, I have just a few more folks here, and the briefer you are, the more I'd be appreciative, but I know you have to say what you have to, and if there's anything written that, again, that could be submitted, that could just be supplemented with brief testimony, that would be great, too. All the members have received all the letters that have been out here, and we read them, and they're in our packet. So, Ronnie Fitzpatrick?
Ronnie is here with me. This is Louise Reed at Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel.
Okay.
I think the thing that we're most interested in is the training, and I certainly understand the folks from Nome and the other bush communities who have real concerns about being able to get the training that they need to do the jobs that they're supposed to be doing in their clinics. Our health corporation has, at this time, four outlying clinics where we do x-rays, and we set up our own program a few years back when we first started this, putting x-ray out in the outlying areas. Now, I'm talking about out on the coast at Emonic and St. Mary's up on the Yukon, Aniak north on the Kuskokwim, and Bethel, of course, our hub, is on the Kuskokwim River. We're 85 miles inland from the mouth. We have another clinic out at Tuksuk. But our concern, or my concern, as director of diagnostic imaging in this department, was that our people who are taking x-rays have the training that they need to do a good job and not over-radiate their patients. So we set up our own training course from the hospital here. We had our students come in from the clinics to spend some time in Bethel, and we also kept in contact daily with them as they were taking x-rays. A book that was very invaluable to me is a book called Radiography Essentials for Limited Practice. This is a book that was put out by, Scripps Memorial Hospital Educational Services, and anyone can order this book. In fact, it was brought to my notice by one of my technologists here who wanted to get the book and take the exams that come with the book in order to get CME. It gave him, there's two parts to it. It gave him 20 CEUs for the first part and 12 and a half for the second part. But I will say that this is the same book that we're using in our class with UAA. UAA has just started a limited license or limited radiography program using our hospital and our students in our outlying clinics as a beta test station for the rest of the state. So we just started this program in January. It's delivered through distance education. They all have a computer where they are, and they're able to dial in to, they meet once a week, and the rest of it is done at their own time. So we have great hopes that this program through UAA will be the kind of the standard for the rest of the state as we work out all the bugs. I have Ronnie Fitzpatrick here with me right now. She is our program director here at the hospital, and she works with our students who are out in the outlying clinics. I also have one of our students here, Sue Miller, who is in that program. She actually works here at the Bethel Hospital. So we are very interested in seeing this bill pass. We think that it's doable. We believe that the people who are taking x-rays do need the training, especially in safety and radiobiology. We are concerned about our patients and the radiation they're getting, and not only the radiation, but the ability of the people taking the x-rays to do them in a manner that they know the positioning so that they can get the pictures for the radiologist that he needs to make a good diagnosis, to make a proper diagnosis. So anyway, like I say, our concern is that the people have the training that they need to do the job they're expected to do, and we feel like we're in a good position to get this started for the people in the state that need the training.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reed.
You're welcome. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to give my phone number to whoever might like to come to call us. We can let them know where to get this book.
Okay, what is that?
I'm sorry?
What is that phone number?
907-543-6409 is into my office, or 6238 is our main x-ray number.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Devlin.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi, Madam Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to testify against this bill. I'll be brief. The bill will negatively impact access to care in rural Alaska. It'll increase the cost of that care, and it won't necessarily guarantee safety. We're in a situation. We have 9 clinics, 4 of which have X-rays out in the Aleutian Islands. We have injuries with crab boats and processors. The Coast Guard brings them in. It's a essential tool that we use for diagnostic purposes. We make sure people get some training, but to have to go through another state regulatory process and licensing will only increase our cost and. At the worst, we probably won't be able to take x-rays for long periods of time as people come on and we're not able to give them the in-house training that we give them now. I think you mentioned it, unless you would just give a rural exception or a remote safety net exception, it probably won't work for rural Alaska, and that's probably what you need to do. At any rate, that's my